Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss telecommunications transactions and the public interest. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome three experts to our call today. We have a moderator for today's call. We'll leave it to our moderator to introduce the other two experts. They're going to have some opening remarks followed by some discussion, but ultimately we'll be coming to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions. Welcome as our moderator, the Honorable Harold Furchgoth Roth, of the Hudson Institute. At Hudson, he is the director of their Center for Economics of the Internet. With that, Mr. Furchgoth Roth, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. It's a great honor to be here on the Federalist Society event. We have today two outstanding speakers to address today's topic. One is Michael Copps. He is a special advisor to the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Michael is a very good friend. He had a long and distinguished tenure at the Federal Communications Commission, where he was a member from 2001 to 2011, always known for his calm demeanor and for his straightforward approach to issues. After Commissioner Copps speaks, we'll have Will Reinhart, who is Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum, where he specializes in telecommunications, internet, and data policy with a focus on emerging technologies and innovations. Will is one of the most articulate speakers on internet issues, I very much look forward to his remarks as well. Each speaker will speak for no more than 10 minutes. I'm going to set my alarm clock to go off after 10 minutes, and if one of the speakers is still speaking, I will nudge in at that point. We'll give an opportunity for the speakers to reply to each other, and then we'll open it up to our audience for questions. And with that, let me turn things over first to Commissioner Michael Copps.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon to everybody. Thanks to Dean and Will and my friend Brian Tremont to convince me to do this today. I'm looking forward to it. And a special nod to my friend Harold Furchgoth Roth. I appreciate the kind words he just said about me. We go back a long ways. I think shortly after I was nominated by President Bush and before I'd been approved by the Senate, Harold, who had already departed the commission, I think was maybe the first person to reach out to me, and we went out and had lunch, and he explained some of the folkways of the commission to me and was very helpful. And we disagree on many issues, but we have been fast friends since then, continue to be. And I think we both harken back to kind of a earlier day where people can disagree without being nasty and remain friends and understand that compromise is the oil that should be keeping the government running. We don't have too much of that oil right now, but I've always thought that getting together and talking with everybody about these issues works best. I did a panel with Dick Wiley last week. I remained good friends with my buddy Rob McDowell and Debbie Tate and Kevin Martin and all. So just by way of introduction, thanks. I'm sure that many members of the society find the operations of our government more than a little bit wanting right now. I find them sorely lacking, perhaps for different reasons, but I do think that the state of our nation is not too great, and I think the price we are paying for the politics we have is costing America and costing it dearly. I recently had an opportunity to go down to Orange, Virginia, which is right near Montpelier, the estate of James Madison. And while I was there, I brought a fresh copy of the Federalist Papers, which I hadn't spent much time on since I was in graduate school in American History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill many, many years ago. But just perusing those pages now, I'm amazed at the brilliance that they exhibit, the intelligence they show, and the assumption that our founders made that perhaps the most important part of what they were doing in government was to make sure that they had a citizenry that was informed with news and information so they could make intelligent decisions for the future of the nation. And we seem to have lost a little bit of sight of that now, but that's kind of where I'd like to start today, because that's really the assumption of what animated me at the commission and continues to animate me at Common Cause, whether our communications, our newspaper, our radio, our television, our cable, our internet, all of which do many things, linking us together and facilitating business and spreading the arts, and the list goes on. But are they fulfilling this important purpose of advancing the public interest and giving people the sustenance and the information they need in order that they can practice the art, I think Elihu Root called it the practical art of self-government. And, you know, this goes back to those James Madison that I was talking about in Washington and Jefferson, who put a lot of emphasis, including the passage of laws on this, because they realized that they were heading into uncharted waters, so that there was no guarantee that the system of government that they had devised was going to work. And, you know, I always go back to those quotes, Thomas Jefferson, the basis of our government being the opinion of people, the very first object of government should be to keep that right. And we're left to me to decide whether we shall have a government without newspapers or newspapers without government. I would not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Then, very interestingly, he added, but I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them. That was kind of universal service, 1800 style. And then there's Madison himself, who we all know the quote about a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. And I think we're sliding down the hill and meeting that challenge that they set out for us. It's not just a threat, but it's a reality. All you have to do is look at the state of our media today, the state of our journalism, the demise, or certainly the diminution of investigating reporting, the substitution of infotainment for information. A journalism profession that's probably lost a third, at least, of its workforce. Journalism that no longer has much news about state bureaus or foreign bureaus or local news. All those things have taken a major hit. And we can talk for a long time about the causes of all of this, and people will talk, well, new technology, decline of the newspaper. But I think right up there at the head of the pack, the primary driver of this has been industry consolidation, all the gobbling up of independent outlets, local stations, driven by the need to satisfy the expectations of the marketplace, which just continue to rise and rise and rise. And what I've seen is the first reaction to all of these mergers that we've had in order to finance the debt that's been undertaken is to downsize, downsize, and boy, have they downsized radio, television, cable. Now, supposedly the internet was going to be exempt from all of this back in the age of exuberance in the late 1990s. I remember very well when I was fighting the media ownership battles with Michael Powell beginning in 2000, a lot of people thought, well, this fellow Copps is just talking about radio and TV and cable, and he's an old-timer, and this new internet, wow, it's exempt from the rules of the marketplace, the rules of business, the rules of history, powers at the edges, and nobody can ever do anything about it. Really an irrational exuberance. And what I see now, you won't all agree, but is our internet headed down the same road toward consolidation? in gatekeeping, and the power moving from the edges to the center, and it becoming drifting away from the public interest. You know, when we move everything to the internet, our so much of the way we live, our lives, our jobs, our education, but also our civic dialogue, that internet becomes immensely invested with the public interest. So what we need to have in this country, once we get beyond, hopefully, all the specifics of net neutrality and everything else, is a real conversation about the future of the internet. Do we just let it go down this road? And I think each day the commercialization, the consolidation, the hits on journalism only compound. Or do we find a way, really, in some ways, to make sure that the public interest is protected? We should be in really a golden age of communications with the tools that we have, but I think we haven't taken advantage of those tools as we should have. Therein is the problem, and I hope that's what we can spend a considerable part of our conversation today on. And with that, I will cease and desist.
Great. Well, thank you, Commissioner Copps. Thank you for those kind words. And let's turn things over to Will Reinhardt.
Thank you very much. And so first off, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for obviously putting this together. And I'm very honored to be on this webinar with two former FCC commissioners, both of whom I've been following for some time and been reading a lot of work by. You know, somebody who has been in this space for a little while, really my entire life has been involved in some form of media production, right now really is an exciting time for me. And as you'll hear my comments, they're a little bit of a different nature than the commissioners. The dynamism that was predicted in the 1990s really has become market reality. So the focus of what I want to talk about today is to kind of go over some of those changes and also explore what agencies should and have been focusing on, including, in fact, everyone's favorite topic, network neutrality. So a little bit about what exactly is happening. Well, content and conduit are clearly evolving, and they're evolving together. On the content side, consumers are faced with more choices, really, than they ever have been before. The growth of TV programming really evinces this expansion of choice. The number of scripted shows this next year will pass something around the range of 400, which is nearly double the shows that existed in 2009. Because of the time-shifting technologies and because of innovation in technologies, the quality itself has improved. And really, by many accounts, we're kind of in this golden age of television. Now, the places where you can watch television have clearly proliferated. Now, in addition to the satellite, which has become a huge competitor, to cable, which was traditionally had the power in this market, telcos have obviously become very important players. But also consumers are going online, and you've seen a huge shift towards various types of online services like HBO Go and Hulu and CBS and Amazon Prime, all of which have been created relatively recently and are really taking advantage of new online networks. Now, the reason why all this has been created is clearly that broadband infrastructure has gotten much better. Just a little bit of information about these networks. From 2011 to 2014, as the FCC recently just released, in about those 3 years between the two, the actual download speeds for the internet have tripled on average. And in just 1 year, the top end speeds increased by about 105%. However, the FCC's numbers really stop at 2014 and don't include many of the changes since then. They don't include the AT&T's Gigapower project. They don't include Google Fiber's expansion. They don't include CenturyLink. They don't include all of the other players that we typically don't talk about in this space, like Windstream, Consolidated, and Fairpoint. So one of the goals, of course, that Chairman Jenikowski laid out in a couple of years back was that there would be 1 gig providers of broadband in almost every single state by 2015. Well, it seems like this year we're about to get that, even though it is a year late, of course. So in addition to broadband speeds, mobile broadband speeds have also become much faster. The FCC has reported with the Mobile Wireless Competition Report, that the average download speed in 2015 was 14 megabytes per second. Cisco predicts that a huge expansion and growth is going to occur over the next couple of years by almost double for mobile broadband providers as compared to fixed broadband providers. What this means of the combination of content and conduit is that the market has become far more fluid. The immediate result has been cord cutting, which we're now seeing an expansion of cord cutting. 5% of all people seem to be, or 5% of all households rather, seem to be cord cutters, and about 16% of all households are cord nevers. And in the next couple of years, by 2019, it seems that about 1/4 of all U.S. households will not pay for the traditional television, which has really been one of the most important parts of FCC regulation. Stepping back for a second, when you think about what this actually means is that there has been a dramatic change in the consumption of the bundle. And in fact, what's probably happening is that we're moving towards a broadband standalone product, which means that then also the video franchise, the fixed costs rather, of video franchising are getting whittled away. And it really changes the calculus for competitive industry and entry into this market. But cord cutting isn't just in the fixed space. And interestingly enough, Pew also found that about 4 out of 10 cord cutters are going with mobile only, which means that there is at least some sort of substitution of fixed mobile broadband towards wireless broadband. And this is actually a paper that I'm working on, and something I'm very, very excited about is really to see where this is going to change the market in the next 3 to 5 years. But largely, this also presents a huge regulatory challenge for policing agencies, especially the FCC. And I want to highlight two big questions here that really plague both the FCC and the DOJ and the FTC, which is, how do we incorporate the explosion of all these kinds of different heterogeneous users in both policy and transaction review? The bigger question really is one that economists have been trying to deal with for some time, which is, how do we incorporate innovation into our thinking on regulatory matters? And the big takeaway when you look at the literature on this subject, and really when you experience it firsthand, is that we really just do not know that much about innovation and innovative markets. If I were to ask you, for example, in 2002, who would be among the most innovative companies in the next 6 to 10 years in the cell phone market space, I don't think that many people would say either Google or Apple would be the two biggest industry players. And it's especially difficult to make these kinds of predictions in deals. We see somewhat of a folly now, but it's important to remember that the FTC actually imposed conditions on the AOL Time Warner merger based on the finding that AOL, as the leading provider of narrowband internet access, was likely to become the leading provider of broadband internet access as well. Now, of course, these are based on very tried and true exclusionary principles. And also, broadband was a developing product, so we knew about what was going on generally in the market. But again, we have really bad tools to understand those markets and those innovations which have yet to be created. To a certain degree, for me, this creates, or at least suggests, some sort of regulatory humility. And I don't want to spend too much time, maybe in the question and answer portion of this, we can talk about the public interest mandate a little bit more. But for me, it's unclear that the FCC is really adapted to deal with the demands that innovative markets really have placed on the industries. And furthermore, it's really kind of unclear if the FCC itself has been a particularly great steward of its power in the transaction review or competition space writ large. I mean, there's a lot of different examples, and the most recent and probably most maddening to me is the one that was the change in broadband speeds last year from 4 megabytes per second to 25 megabytes per second. There was, if I recall correctly, in the filings, there was no major mention of the willingness to pay. There was not even a mention of the broadband access report that had actually singled out the 10 to 15 megabyte level as a competitive level. And what this then generally means going forward is, again, one of the things that I hope that there'll be reforms on. In general, I think that the FCC doesn't right now have the core types of competencies to actually do a proper transaction review process. I harken back to a 2009 study that actually looked at competition agencies across the world, and with all due respect to the lawyers on the line, the one thing that was really missing at the FCC as compared to other agencies were two things, and those were the existence of technologists and economists. This presents then kind of a worrying institutional structure, because two of the most important professionals who clearly have important things to say about all of the proceedings that exist at the FCC really have not been fully integrated in the way that you would really want them to be. Now, the most this was clearly on display within the network neutrality proceeding, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but the presumption within the network neutrality proceeding was that the downstream players have all of the power. Again, that is supported, or at least was largely supported, on the theory of the terminating access monopoly, which again is something we can talk a little bit more about, but that has a number of problems. With that, I'm going to stop here. I know I've hit everyone with a lot of information, a lot of broad topics, but I look forward to both the conversation here and also the audience questions.
Well, thank you very much. Let me see if Commissioner Copps has any immediate responses to some of the many comments that you got through in your comments, Will. Commissioner Copps, do you have any?
Sure, and I appreciate it. There were a lot of things that were said, so this won't necessarily be in logical order, but I certainly would agree it's an exciting time, and we're dealing with a dynamic technology. The evolution of content and conduit is one of the things that really concerns me as we worry about gatekeeping, and we have seen companies evolve that are both content and distribution. I was the only person, some of you may recall, who voted against the NBC Comcast, NBCU Comcast merger a few years ago, basically because it was new media, old media, content, distribution, vertical integration, horizontal integration, programming, and all the rest. Lots is going on. Cord cutting? Yes, indeed. But again, let's look at the totality of the picture. That's fine, but it was Brian Roberts who said, this isn't an exact quote, but what are you talking about with cord cutting? It's all got run over my cables anyhow, and I've seen some reports since then that seem to indicate that those people who are cord cutters are using probably twice the amount of data that there were that those who didn't cut the cord do. So I don't really see, though, just broadly speaking, how you can look at the news and information ecosystem that we are in, with the phenomenon that I talked about earlier, with maybe a loss of a third of our newsroom jobs and closing of state bureaus and overseas bureaus and evolution of infotainment and the lack of investigative reporting, and say that that's really good for the public interest. Let's see, regulatory humility, I agree with that, but I think we had 7 or 8 years at the FCC where we had regulatory abdication, and that's what bothered me. As for the critique, and I agree the FCC deserves to be more fully staffed. I know when Michael Powell was chairman, he made a big effort to bring economists and on and things like that. That was good, lawyers and all that, but my God, we're dealing with a Congress here that you have to just go through major contortions to hold your budget at something resembling what it was last year. When I went to the commission, there was probably close to 2,000 employees there. When Harold was there, it might have been even more. Now I think it's probably more like 1,500 or 1,600, but we've got all these new technologies, all these new revolutions, all the things that Will just talked about, for the FCC to say grace over and to try to have policies forward. So, maybe we all ought to be up in the hill and saying this is a sixth of our economy right now, telecommunications, and here's an agency that's paying for itself, returning money to the government, not a budget shortfall or a budget drain, and we're starving it. And then we criticize it because it doesn't have all the expertise that it should have. And how to increase innovation, last comment, Will talked about the need to increase innovation. I agree We have to have an environment that increases that. But I don't really think that you can demonstrate that all of the consolidation that we've been through has been great for research and development and innovation. I think you can look at many industries in this economy of ours, and one of the first casualties of all of these mergers and the indebtedness that they bring on is to, many of them, cut research and development, in media to cut the news bureau, and I think we have to look at that with something of a jaundiced eye. So those are just a few of my reactions.
Well, thank you, Michael. Will, any response to Michael's comments?
Yes, these are obviously clearly there's a lot going on here. The question about shutting down take a step back for a second. The question about hard news and really where journalism is moving has been something. I mean, I actually helped to when I was a teenager. I helped to found a magazine, and so this idea actually is very near and dear to my heart. But at the same time, to be very clear, there is a bifurcation, at least in the demands of individuals and what necessarily they want and what they display that they want. I mean, this has been one of the big problems: is how do you in a media environment where there clearly is fewer gatekeepers, at least on the internet. And the internet, the production of news and the production of commentary has exploded by all measures. And yet at the same time, so the gatekeeping function in that regard has definitely kind of left the roost. But at the same time, how do you then help, or how do you ensure that people are getting the kind of news that they necessarily need and not necessarily demand? Because it's pretty clear that when you actually look at a number of surveys, people will say, okay, I really do want hard news, but what they actually consume is typically, you know, sports or light news, stuff that isn't really related to heavy political topics. And so there's this, to me, I wonder really what are the solutions to this disconnect between what consumers necessarily demand and what they're showing preferences for, and then at the same time what necessarily they would need in order for more democratic involvement. And so that, to me, it's unclear to me if there's a really great answer absolutely for that at this point, especially with the news going online and with journalists particularly finding Twitter and a lot of these other sources online as their first, you know, as absolutely their first way to get out information. It's kind of unclear to me exactly how we put the genie back in the bottle.
Well, yeah, this is Mike Hobbs. I agree. There's not necessarily a great answer, but there is a great question out there about what the people want versus what the public interest requires. We've lost probably 30,000 jobs in the news workforce and traditional media. If you put everybody together on the internet who's doing news, you've got maybe 5,000. So you still have a serious shortfall. And you know, we all like our McDonald's treats and sandwiches and all that, but we all have to have exposure to another diet. And what I see, I agree with Will that there's an increasing demand for this. I see it as I go around to localities and do town hall meetings around the country, but the tools aren't there. So I want to know more about what's going on at the state level. I want to know more about what the American Legislative Exchange Council has been doing for the last 40 years. I want to know what both liberals and conservatives. I don't look at this in a partisan fashion, but the workforce isn't there. Ditto the foreign bureaus. I think if you look at the coverage of our current election campaign, I mean, the media is turning it into just another reality show, a spectator sport. And I think, you know, I remember growing up back watching the Eisenhower-Adlai-Stevenson race in 1952. You turn on the TV at night, and they'd give a half hour to a candidate to make a speech or be interviewed or something on a single topic, and he'd have to have some kind of a policy backing him up on that, and it would be an opportunity. I'm not saying that was perfect time. We've never had a real golden age, but I think there are other ways to do this. But I think putting together the sustenance or the necessary tools of media ought to be at the top of our list. All the issues we care about, you know, come to us basically through the media. I've often cited you can go around a table of 10 people and ask 10 people what's the most important topic facing the country, and you probably get 10 different answers. And I say that's all well and good, but if you want to make progress on any of those issues, you better have a media that's teeing them up in an in-depth fashion. And that's what I think we're lacking right now, and that's why I tell them media might not be your number one issue, but it better be a pretty close second.
Well, this is great. I have a large number of questions, but I'm going to hold back and let our audience submit questions. Dean, do you want to tell us how we are on audience questions coming in?
Of course. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. If you're in the audience, after you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question pending. After this first question, our lines will be open. Let's take our first call now.
Hello?
Go ahead, Carolyn.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay.
We can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay, great. This is Carolyn Parlata. I'm a longtime member of the Federalist Society. This is not my area of law. So basically, I don't understand why, you know, the lack of an acceptable level of public interest in the news is essentially any of the FCC's business. I mean, if you wanted to be sure you had lots of foreign correspondents, well, you could set up a state news agency and have them all over the world, but that's not a good answer. I just think there's some things that the FCC really can't do, and as far as I understand, they shouldn't do, and yet that's what I hear you saying. Perhaps that's not what you're saying, but that's what I hear. So I would like to understand better why even this is something that you should be addressing. Thank you.
Well, I think it goes back to the very beginning. You know, the regnant Supreme Court doctrine right now, and I hope it remains so, but very clearly in the Red Lion case, that the purpose of the First Amendment is the preservation of an uninhibited marketplace of ideas where truth may ultimately prevail. And again, it goes back to the very beginning, the quotes I gave from Jefferson and Madison. It is a public interest necessity, not a public interest luxury, that the people have news and information necessary to govern themselves in an intelligent fashion. If you don't have foreign bureaus, overseas bureaus, and you're relying on some stringer who you don't know what his or her allegiance might be over there, you're not going to find out what's going on in these countries. Yet we're making important decisions about Iraq, about Syria, about Israel, about the whole world around us. So it seems to me that it's been a constant. It's been a constant in our life. I guess we shied away from it a lot after 1980 until more recently. But to really realize that there is a positive public interest responsibility to make sure we have this uninhibited marketplace of ideas. And if it's not staffed, if it's not peopled, That is our business. It's government's business. There's lots of different ways to go around it. You mentioned state agency. Of course, everybody says, oh, well, you're talking government ownership of media, or you're talking tremendous public assistance to media, and you can't really have that without government taking over the media. But yet you look at a lot of countries, Scandinavian countries and otherwise, where they have robust public assistance to media, and they rank way ahead of the United States, according to The Economist, when they publish their democracy index each and every year. So we have to experiment. We have to have trial and error. If we're going to have this discussion in the future of the Internet, which I think we need to discuss, then we ought to be looking at how do you incent news on there? What models are there? Is there nonprofit media? Are there tax incentives? Is there public assistance? I don't have an easy answer, but I think the country is at peril if it doesn't step up and address this instead of just letting us continue down the road we're going, where we get less and less in the way of, as I say, investigative reporting and real news about what's going on at various levels of government, nationally and globally, too.
Well,
am I still on? Am I still? Can you still hear me?
I can still hear you.
Oh, okay. I just didn't know whether I had been shut off. But my point is, you can't, I don't think, without some sort of draconian change in the law, that you can make it happen. There are, in actual fact, far more news outlets, given that there is the internet, lots of magazines, lots of newspapers. I would agree that most of them do a fairly poor job, but they exist, and they're supplying a demand. I mean, I think you'd be maybe better off in trying to reintroduce civics in education into elementary, K through 12 schools, than actually trying to force feed people news. They still don't have to. They still don't have to listen to it.
Well, I just don't
understand that's the FCC's mandate.
I can certainly understand and agree. I can certainly agree with you that having a K through 12 media literacy or new literacy or whatever you want to call it program would very much benefit the country. This is an important sector, as I was saying, of our national life together, and I agree with you that one agency can't solve it. But recognize, too, according to my friend Professor Matt Hinman here in Washington, D.C., the last time he surveyed, 0.1% of the hits on the internet had anything to do with local news. 0.1%. I mean, compared to pornography or something else, or just entertainment generally, it's a pretty small slice. But I just think, as citizens, we all have an interest in this, or we're all going to pay the price. And I think we already have paid the price by significantly, and maybe it's a harsh term, but significantly dumbing down our civic dialogue. And given the challenges that we face right now, open questions about our ability to really exercise the kind of leadership we all want our country to exercise, how you can do that without having some changes in the media and talking about them, and it might take a lot of compromise to get where we need to go. I would hope when the next president of the United States comes in, first thing he or she would do would be to set up a commission of private citizens, some of the public agencies, with a timetable to report back to the people, like less than a year, on what are some of the really good proposals, what are some of the proposals that we can do to enhance this without doing damage to innovation, actually encouraging it, without doing damage, without being draconian. Are there things in public and private partnerships that we can do? Are there really some steps that can be taken in the public interest? And again, I don't think there's any higher calling for our government right now.
Will, do you have comments on this topic of please go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot here. First off, I mean, just a general comment about what the FCC has at least done in the past. I mean, one of the biggest criticisms of the FCC has actually been in trying to determine exactly what type of content is aired. I mean, one of the biggest and probably most controversial topics in this is obviously the Fairness Doctrine, which when it was repealed in the 80s, in the late 80s, it really was the beginning of conservative talk radio. And it also was very important to helping to build out some more of the evangelical Christian radio stations that seemed to have proliferated after the 1980s. I guess the big question for me is, the public interest mandate to me, you know, if we're going to go down that route, which, you know, obviously it is part of the FCC's mandate. But within that, I would at least like to see some sort of articulation of exactly what that means in practice. What is it that we're looking to achieve? What is it that the public interest really provides over and above any of the other any of the other kind of markers of competition that we've actually done a lot of work on. And some sort of articulation has been something that I've been calling for some time now by the FCC on exactly what it means. Something akin to, I mean, I know this topic is much more on merger control and, I mean, rather on transaction reviews on mergers and all of that. But just having something that articulates what exactly the public interest would mean in, for example, in mergers would actually, I think, be very, very important and an important step, at least in the FCC, trying to clean up its own house. And related to that, it's very much, I wonder whether, again, I mean, I would just reiterate that to me, it seems like the cat's kind of out of the bag. I mean, at one point in the past, the audience attention was clearly directed at local television, or rather at local network television, primarily because it was the only thing that you could access. But what has happened, at least with the newest generation and at least the millennial generation of which I'm a part, there's been a clear change in what millennials specifically, what they actually do on a daily basis. So implementing a system or trying to put back some type of organizational structure, which at the end it really wouldn't work anyway. The reason I say this is because when you look at the amount of time that's spent on various different media, when you look at the radio advertising funds, when you look at television broadcast funds, when you look at internet television advertising, all of the advertising seems to chunk out by the percentage of the time that individuals spend on those mediums. In other words, given that the current system really is an ad-supported system, it seems to be at least some sort of equilibrium level where individuals, or rather the industries themselves, are getting the amount of advertising dollars that are consistent with the amount of time that individuals are spending on those platforms. And so putting something back into a system, pushing it backwards and saying, well, we need to put more money back into the broadcast system or the newspaper system isn't going to help because individuals aren't on those platforms, aren't consuming those kinds of media to begin with. So there's a bit of an industry structure problem to me. And then of course there is the issue of what exactly the FCC is, the proper role of the FCC in regulatory processes.
Well, it's Mike Ops. I spent a lot of years trying to describe what I think the public interest is when it comes to these things. And I think it's pretty clear, even though somebody pretty famous once said he waited for the angel of the public interest to come and see him when he was appointed to the commission, and the angel never came. I think it's pretty clear in telecom, the public interest is pretty clearly the delivery of the most advanced telecommunications possible to every citizen, reasonably comparable services between rural and urban, competition among providers, consumer protection, and the safety of the people. And in media, I think it means localism, diversity, competition, and news and information that sustains the public dialogue. Localism isn't a mysterious or an ethereal concept. It means providing residents of a local community with a diverse cultural programming and opportunities for self-expression, access to solid, in-depth public affairs programming about local and national affairs. That's essential to democracy. Yes, the platforms are changing. Yes, the newspapers, although I did read a report the other day that more than half the people who access the newspapers, many of them through the Internet, but over half are still using that paper edition, and I think newspapers probably would have fared much better in an environment where the previously local and independent newspaper that was maybe making 8 or 9 or 10% a year didn't all of a sudden find itself in a corporate environment. Well, that's great if you made 11% last year. Make sure you do 15 this year, and you made 15, and then the station or whatever has to go to 20 the next year, and it's kind of the unforgiving expectations of the marketplace. Go down that road, do business with us, or get the hell off of the island. And I think I'm not ready to give up on newspapers yet, but I certainly do agree with Will that we have to have some plans. Again, an indulgent conversation, a reasonable discourse among the citizenry about how we can replace some of what has been lost in traditional media, replace it in new media, and try to get to that golden age where both of them are playing a role. 75% of the news, maybe more than that, still comes from the newspaper, still comes from the television broadcaster, not coming from the Internet.
Let's see if we can get some more questions. Dean, other questions waiting?
Can I do one small – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Will. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We don't have any questions pending right now. Right. Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, but then go ahead, Will.
Yeah, so the one thing that at least – so, yes, I agree that there has been an articulation of the public interest, but exactly what that means in practice and what are the competing forces, I think is also very, very important when you put it into practice. And the reason I say this is very specific. When you look at two of those very important parts of the public interest, one part is, of course, diversity, and the other part is localism. And yet those aren't necessarily exactly the same thing that's going to happen, at least at a local level. You can imagine two different scenarios. And in one scenario, it is that the work towards localism has multiple providers. But because you have a multiple provider of whatever that service may be, that those individuals always go for the median consumer. They always go for the median individual, such that at least locally, the demand for competition for competition at a local level could also mean that the broader the niche view, the small view, the individual who is kind of radical in their own beliefs, they will not be specifically dealt with via the media. So I mean, it's not absolutely clear that even the articulation of the public interest mandate, even as it's currently understood, really doesn't have kind of complexities and paradoxes within it to begin with. So, and again, how do we actually work that out then with mergers and competition? I think also just becomes very problematic in a way that I think that there just needs to be far more guidance on. And potentially, I mean, for me, I would like to see some sort of overhaul where the public interest mandate gets some sort of articulation that's at least helpful for upcoming mergers, for upcoming competition, and for consumers of all sorts to know kind of exactly what is it that the FCC is trying to articulate here.
Well, I think if the net neutrality debate establishes anything, it is that there's an agency of the government that has some responsibility over the evolution of our internet right now. You're absolutely right. Localism and diversity are two different things, and I've said as recently as last week on a panel in town that my biggest disappointment in 11 years at the FCC was our inability to do more on diversity, to be responsive to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which overturned returned to the Commission Michael Powell and Kevin Martin's media ownership rules. I think it's the FCC's ongoing embarrassment. We still haven't done the Hedorin and the Prometheus mandate. We haven't gathered the facts about who owns what. We know there's a real paucity of minority-owned and female-owned stations. I've always said there are things that the FCC can do, even while it does the surveys and research necessary to satisfy the Third Circuit Court. But,
Michael, you introduced the idea of network neutrality. Why don't we move on to network neutrality, which has been argued before the D.C. Circuit Court, and it's perhaps the biggest policy issue that's been before the commission.
Okay.
I'd like to get both of your views about how network neutrality plays into this issue of the media and how that is going forward, particularly with respect to First Amendment issues for broadband providers.
Okay. Well, this is Mike. I guess just in broad outline, net neutrality means consumers are free to access the lawful content of their choice, run applications and of their choice, attach devices of their choice, and enjoy the benefits of transparency and non-discrimination and now non-prioritization of content. Also that ISPs are not able to favor their businesses over the business of others. So it's very important, as I indicated in the last question, I think perhaps the most important part of net neutrality is not just the specific stipulations of net neutrality, But the fact that it kind of opens the door to having a discussion of what's the balance going to be and between public and private input and all the rest. But net neutrality, important as it is not the only issue that's at stake as we look at the future of the media. If you look at the mega charter merger, I think that would be bad for cable carriage and may threaten independent and diverse programming. You know, we all talk about over-the-top video now, but the more gatekeeping you get, the more control over that over-the-top programming there's going to be. And diversity of content on the cable dial doesn't have a lot to do with net neutrality. Net neutrality can't contain the runaway price increases that you get from regional sports networks. So it's huge. I'm not underestimating it. I think the vote that the FCC took on net neutrality was the most important one that's been taken in a generation. But we still have to consider these other dimensions of the Internet going forward, and that's what I'm primarily talking about today.
Sure. Will?
Yeah, I guess the worry that I had with what the commission has done on this is, and it's multifold, but one of the basic and big problems on my end is that the presumption, as I think I mentioned in my talk, is that there's a presumption here that the downstream players have all the power, which, again, is supported by this theory of the terminating access monopoly, or at least has been articulated as such. But we know this isn't necessarily the case, and it's really not true if the content itself is differentiated. One of the analogies that I like to point to, of course, is the Time Warner Cable CBS blackout, where something like 275,000 subscribers actually switched to another retailer because they did not have CBS content. But more to the point, when you actually look at the Internet structure doesn't really support this idea, for example, of a terminating access monopoly. Not just was it built and kind of supported through the telecommunications regime, of which the important part of that was the tariff. But the way the Internet's structured isn't the tariffing structure that the terminating access monopoly actually purports to be. And the reason I say this is because when you look at smaller providers, when you look at smaller ISPs, they actually have to pay money to get onto the Internet. They have to pay a transit fee typically. Now, larger providers do not have to pay this fee. And again, this is really kind of arcane. Transaction deals within the Internet itself. But the larger point just exists is that the network itself really just doesn't comport very well to this theory that there isn't any power on the top end if there is power on the bottom end. I can get a little bit more into that if you'd like to and talk about, you know, multiple transit providers. But again, the network itself is stochastic, and the FCC thought and really articulates the network as being deterministic, and it's really that issue which is really first and foremost to me. What that means in theory. Now let's set that aside for a second. Let's set the problems with the FCC's network neutrality the Open Internet Report and Order. Setting that aside, if it is the case that in fact what network neutrality will do if it goes through the courts, then many of the concerns about content players seem to not really exist. So at least with the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger, the exact worry was that Comcast was actually going to limit OVDs. But this is exactly what network neutrality is supposed to ensure that consumers are protected against. So it seems to me there'd be a tension and a paradox here between the regulatory rule, and then, for example, competition and mergers that have been shot down because they do not comport to something that is supposed to be protected by the network neutrality rules anyway.
I guess I would only react that to my way of thinking, wherever there's discrimination on the Internet, whether it's downstream, midstream, or whatever, there's a problem. I think the Commission's network neutrality rules were more specific when it came to the downstream, but I think there was also a recognition that there could be problems up there, but that the Commission would be dealing with those as it goes down the road, more on a case-by-case basis. Some of us might like to have seen more than that enacted, myself included, but but pretty much we're still attained in the rule. But I think a lot of that is to be worked out. But you know, it all comes back to the consumer in the final analysis. And if charges are going to be added on with regard to the immediate downstream providers or the midstream providers, it's going to be the consumers that pay the cost. So I think that's pretty clear.
Let me ask a hypothetical question. Let's say you're an ISP and you want to, or you are currently or previously offered a service that blocks certain sites that primarily provide pornography, or maybe it's the ISIS recruitment site, or there's a handful of sites that the ISP owner said, you know what, these are not good sites, so I'm just going to block them. And previously they were blocking them. Now, under the Open Internet Order, it's against the law now to block sites unless they're completely unlawful sites. Is that something that you think the commission ought to take a look at? Or do you think the government has the right to tell ISPs that even if their customers sign up for a service to block certain sites, that they're not allowed to offer that?
Well, I think it's something that, the first responsibility of government is to protect the safety of the people. I think most people would agree on that. So I think it's legitimate for the FCC to be looking at. I think it's legitimate for the administration to be looking at that. I'm not convinced that the ability to do something about those is as absent as you think. I'd have to think about that a little bit more, but we have to look at these problems in their totality and the threats they bring, and it seems to me some of the recruitment stuff that's not illegal, it's getting pretty close.
Will?
I had my phone muted there. Generally speaking, I've been not particularly positive about the network neutrality rules for a number of various reasons, primarily because I think that a lot of what could be dealt with could probably be, or, you know, a lot of the potential problems could be dealt with via normal regulatory rules, and it's clear that at least a significant portion of exactly what the FCC was worried about is actually was solved through other regulatory proceedings and through other regulatory measures. That being said, what you just laid out actually it seems to me to be exactly the problem. And I know that if I remember this correctly, that there's actually a number of Christian ISP services that do exactly this, that in fact block out some content, including pornography. And to me, so you've had this tension between at least some sort of editorial discretion on the case of the broadband provider, and then that's butting up against the network neutrality as it needs to actually exist in the world. And again, I would not want that to happen by any means, but I also think that there's a lot of very serious holes when it comes to the First Amendment issues with specifically compelling broadband providers to speak when they might not necessarily want to. Those have not been brought up by the court, and they may get a hearing, though it's unlikely that they're going to with this most recent round of court cases. But again, it is something that has continually been brought up. There's at least some lower court cases that suggest that, in fact, yeah, broadband providers do have some sort of editorial discretion, that it probably is extended to them. So this question, I think, is huge, and it's important, and it really is something that the FCC and the administration probably should have thought about a little bit more carefully. But also, I think that it really punches some major holes into the network neutrality order as it currently stands.
Well, I think with the network neutrality orders, my cops, again, we took a joint step forward. Obviously, we haven't resolved all of the problems, but I think we've made it clear that there is an agency that can take part in all of this. I don't agree that we could have handled all of this by normal regulatory rules, unless you want to call Title II, which I guess I would, a normal regulatory rule, but we got away from that for so many years. So at least now we will have, once the courts get through with this, I hope, the ability of the FCC to further resolve some of these things, working with the private sector. And that's certainly my hope going forward.
Great. Well, Dean, how are we on time? Looks like we're up against 2 o'clock.
We are up against our time. I don't know if anybody wants to take 30 seconds or so for a final thought before we adjourn.
Well, I guess my final thought would be come let us reason together approach. It's obvious from today's discussion that these are complex problems. There are no facile answers. There are no just symbolic sound bites that solve all of this. It takes some goodwill and a real discussion, but I think that discussion has to extend now far beyond us in our phone conversation or even the agencies of government, and a discussion that journalism encourages, that the media encourages, about the future of these things, because they are so integral to the success of our system of government and our ability to count on prosperous futures for ourselves and a competitive place leading the pack for the United States in global competition.
Yeah, and also I would just, again, like to thank everyone for inviting me on this call. One last final comment, obviously, as the commissioner had said, that these are really important issues, and I have worked, especially with some of the staff that the commissioner has, and, you know, I obviously like a lot of the work that they do, and even though I may disagree at the end of the day, you know, to a certain extent, it's important that these conversations are being aired. The other thing that I would say just generally is that I really very much intend to continue working on this, and especially kind of applying the econometric models that I'm fond of, really to try to understand some of these issues, and especially as the markets themselves develop, I'm really very excited by a whole slew of new tools that we have to actually kind of get at some of these questions. So while it may not have by any means all the answers, I'm very excited and would love to work with anyone on this call with going forward.
Carol, a final thought.
Great. Well, we've had a lively discussion today. I want to thank our speakers, Will Reinhart and Michael Copps, and I want to thank the Federal Society for hosting this event.
And we thank Harold.
And this is
Dean. Yeah, thank you very much.
Closing things out, let me thank the three of you on behalf of the Federalist Society. It's been a very interesting discussion. I want to thank our audience as well for joining us today. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be talking about, as the breaking news of the day, I suppose, at least in some circles, the Tyco inversion with Johnson Controls. Tomorrow's topic on teleforum will be corporate inversions. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.